the show.
Well, hey, everyone, and welcome to this week's show. We are here for another week and glad that you are with us wherever you are, whether you're sitting at your desk or maybe running or maybe in the car. Whatever. We love that you are joining with us, though we do want you to contact us occasionally, okay? Write to us, editor@boundless.org, and just let us know where you're listening. We love it. Or post on our Facebook page. We love it when we get sponsors for our show, and this week's sponsor is Everyday Relationships, Focus on the Family's new live call-in hosted by Dr. Greg Smalley and Susie Larson. And if you can't stand another family reunion, wedding, or a holiday get-together, especially heading into the summer, one of those barbecues where everyone's like, why are you still single? Well, then you need to learn how to do relationships well, and they give some great insight. Dr. Smalley is a psychologist. Susie is a very popular radio host, and they really get into the issues and allow listeners to call in and be part of the conversation. So check it out at everydayrelationships.com. Listen online or listen live and make sure that you call in and or comment. Let us know what you think. We've got a great show for you this week. We are talking about relationships, different aspects of that. Really an interesting kind of hodgepodge of topics we're talking about this week. First of all, we have one of our counselors in for an inbox question from a listener who wants to look at a future of dating, given the fact that she actually has a sexually transmitted disease. And so she's wondering, what does that mean for her? Is dating, you know, not an option for her? Does she only need to find people who are, you know, who also have STDs or whatever? Or what is some, you know, what is some advice for her as far as like broaching that topic as she does date? So really honest question, and we appreciate that. For our culture segment, we have the wonderful Dr. John Townsend here in the studio. You know Dr. Townsend. He writes a lot with Dr. Cloud, who we've had on the show, authors of Boundaries and a bunch of other books. And here he's talking about beyond boundaries. So this is like once you've set your boundaries, and then you realize maybe you need to like let some of your boundaries down. You've been hurt in the past. You have trust issues. How do you go back into the fray? So good discussion with him. So looking forward to that. And then here we are for our roundtable. Oh, this is going to be fun, you guys. I think we're going to get a lot of feedback on this one because we are talking about that elusive second date. Many of us have sat by the phone. Well, I don't know if guys sit by the phone. Women have sat by the phone or sat by our phones with the text waiting to see if we're going to get asked out again. And of course, you always finish the date thinking, oh, I think that went well. And then it's just crickets and you're like, apparently it didn't go well. So it's very sad. And so we have four of us here at the table who are going to talk about second dates, our own experience with that. And what really, is there some magic thing that has to happen on the first date to prompt a second one? We have two guys here. We have Andrew and Nathan. Thank you guys for showing up.
Hey.
Because you know I'm getting up in your business about this, okay? So,
that's
sorry,
what I was afraid of.
It's too late. anyway, and then Martha and I are here with a box of Kleenex. So, we're ready. Martha has one in her hand already. Bless her heart.
The Kleenex is out of Andrew's
reach. She's good to go.
Yeah.
So we're, yeah.
I might need some puffs.
Exactly. Though Nathan is now married. He's coming up on 1 year.
Correct.
So he's been on more than two dates with his wife, which is awesome.
Too many to count.
You've actually, that's good. You've made it even further. You're going strong. So that's good. So you're gonna give some advice to the guys out there, though, on how to, you know, how to keep it going.
Yeah,
how
I hope so. I hope to be able to do that.
How to continue to get to know that girl after the first date. That's good. All right. Well, I want to start the conversation with a question, kind of as you guys look at your own dating history. What would you say, I need an assessment here. I want a number or a ballpark idea. What percentage of your first dates have turned into second dates? Do you get to the second date? Are you a second dater? Or are you just dead in the water? Oh, be honest.
Oh my gosh. I think I would say 40-50%.
Okay.
More because I have to explain that because for me, getting to a second date isn't as hard as getting to a third date. So there've been I've had a lot of people that I've gone out with a couple times and then it doesn't seem to go anywhere after that.
Okay,
so.
Is that like the law of diminishing returns or something? I don't know what that's about.
I don't know.
Like an algorithm there somewhere.
Yeah, so I don't know why. Okay. Why two isn't hard, but sometimes And occasionally too, I don't make it to second date. So,
well, I think it's probably because, like, usually within your first date, you don't probably talk about Puritans a lot. But then by the second date, you let your guard down, and then they're like,
meow. Yeah, the second date requirements for Puritanism is really high for me. Yeah. Puritan theology,
exactly.
Is a must.
Well, we'll work on that. All right, Nathan, from your experience.
Oh, I'd say about 20%. Yeah, I'd say
low percentage.
2 of 10, 1 of 5, if you prefer to pare it down.
Can I ask a clarifying question?
Yeah.
Are you guys talking about you've asked for a second date and only that amount of time the girl said yes?
Oh, are you saying this is because of you or because of them?
It's a good point. It's because of me.
Okay.
But I would also qualify it with the fact that you're talking about dates over a long period of time, 8 years of a dating history or so. And that's also 8 years of maturity, where I judged her a lot harsher in those younger years than I did a little bit later. So I would say my second dates came about easier when I got older, because she didn't have to fit as many cultural stereotypes that I'd been fed and believed. Mm-hmm. So my maturity had a lot to do with that.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's good.
Yeah, I would say for the most part, like as I think back, there have been both situations where there might be a second date where I would like to go out with a second time and it's not reciprocated. Mm-hmm. But probably, like, most of the examples I think of are where I don't initiate. Mm-hmm.
And I may not have initiated because I didn't think she was interested, and I came to find out either a roundabout way or directly that she was. Mm. And that was frustrating to me, because I felt like, well, I had no idea. I thought you were bored to tears. I didn't think our conversation was great. But again, some of that I think goes back to how I perceived things a decade ago versus 10 years later, when I had a little bit better perception about those things.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting. Well, for me, I would say probably 80 or 90% of the time gone on a second date. But it's not like I've dated a lot. So
is that because you bring baked goods on the first one? That would up your chances, I'm sure. Okay. Just checking.
Yeah. So...
Okay.
Wait, that they don't turn into a second date?
Well, so of the maybe, well, I don't know.
Oh, 80% don't.
I've been on probably less than 10 first dates. Okay. We're just going to lay it all at the table today. Okay. And one time I was not asked on a second date.
That's going to triple after this show. So.
And then one time I told him I was not interested in a second date. Okay. But every other time I would say there was a second date.
Okay. I would say that for me, most of the ones that did not get to a second date, I was already leery about a first date with them. Mm-hmm. I was pretty much like, I'm not sure that I'm really into this person, but I'm going to give them a air quotes chance. And usually it wasn't even because I don't think they're that interesting. It was some bona fide weirdness. So I think most of mine have been like really good or really tanked. Like, I don't have many average experiences. So,
see, I would say most of my experiences have been in that. Like, I haven't had any like total disasters, but there've been. Like, I feel like, if we're gonna lay everything on the table, there's probably a lot of times where there should have been, a second date, or I should have probably. Like, I look back and I'm like, I don't know what happened there. Like, and the buck stops with me, as the man.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so that brings me to my next question, which is, what then is your expectation on a first date? When you go into this first date, have you already thought it through? I mean, guys, obviously there's a reason you asked this person out. So what do you think is supposed to happen? And as you look back on that, do you think your expectations have been too high historically? Or do you think that you're just not on your game? Or do you think, like, what are you hoping to see happen on this first date?
I definitely think conversation should flow easily. And I know that sounds cliche, but there's a difference between a conversation that works and a conversation that's moving. Mm-hmm. And you can carry on a conversation with a lot of people that doesn't go anywhere. But I feel like a good date, the conversation goes somewhere. And by the end of that date, you can say, okay, I know things about this person that are not the cliche stereotype. Do you have a dog? Mm-hmm. What, do you like this movie? There's more about this person that's a depth that I'm intrigued about versus I like to have fun and I like movies and I like to go to the park. And who doesn't? The definition of fun is that you enjoy it. So I feel like as long as I can say from point A to point B when the date ends that I'm intrigued by this woman for reasons that have to do either spiritually, experiences in her life that she's lived, questions she's asked me. I have to be selfish and say she's got to ask me some questions and not talk the whole time. Mm-hmm. But to the guys out there, that reciprocates. So don't talk the whole time either.
Mm-hmm. And I think there's a certain level of, I think there are a lot of people that aren't even self-aware of mm-hmm. that. Because I've been on dates where, and I actually like to ask questions, so I do, but I'm just like, never get questions in return. And yeah. I'm just like,
that's
rude. Yeah, that's just bad.
Because I'm interesting people, and people should be asking questions about me, okay?
You should want to know me. Exactly. Yeah, but I do think that is, I mean, that's a huge key on a first date is to relax and just, you know, just ask, you're getting to know this person, and the question should be pretty light. I think, you know, when you think about the things that, like that, the kind of tank a first date, it's, you know, going too deep too fast, mm-hmm. or I think a lot of times, you know, we subconsciously have these things we're nervous about, like when somebody knows this about me, you know, that will probably derail any relationship. And so there's this tendency to get that on the table. Like, mm-hmm. and so we slip that in there way before the relationship's ready for it. Mm-hmm. Like kind of like, well, if this tanks it, you know, it was never meant to be. And, you know, and that's not necessarily the best way to build a relationship. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, so I think that, you know, asking like just kind of questions, learning how to do that kind of the dating small talk where, because I think that people that ask good questions, we naturally think are interesting. Mm-hmm. Like when yeah. you're talking to somebody, it's like, wow, you ask really interesting questions about myself and questions about myself that I have to think about a little bit. Like, yeah. I wonder how I'd answer that.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so how do you do that without being like, I mean, everyone's sitting there listening now and just going like, okay, do I have to be like Barbara Walters? Because, I mean, it's already, a first date's already intimidating and kind of scary. And are some, yeah. I mean, do you guys have experiences where either you or the person you went on the date with was just off their game? I mean, you knew, and I mean, did you just say, okay, that's done, or I don't want to find out any more about them, or they're just boring, or no. why are they so awkward?
Well, whatever. I think a big part of all of this is the context of how you first met. Mm-hmm. I mean, if this yeah. is a person that you've been friends with for a long time, or someone you met online and you're meeting face to face for the first time, or you set up and don't know this person at all, mm-hmm. I think that's going to impact your conversation.
That's true. That's a good yeah. point. Mm-hmm. If there's history there, mutual acquaintance that sets you up, online date, all those different things factor into the situation. But I do put it on the guys to facilitate the ease of the conversation, you know, maybe break down a wall that would be really formal. If you're at a restaurant and it's super nice versus a casual restaurant, that's a big difference. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. if you're having a first date at like some super romantic, you've got a waiter right behind you at the ready at all time to fill your water, then that's a little more intimidating than just a burger joint somewhere. Mm-hmm. So I think that's important too. It's up to the guy to kind of create an atmosphere of, hey, this is fun. This mm-hmm. is light. I'm not expecting to be on one knee by the end of this date. Mm-hmm. You wouldn't see me again anyway if I was.
Yeah. That's part of, I think it's part of a guy's leadership.
Yeah.
Like you want to show in your dating, you know, maybe, I mean, there's different ways to do this, and especially initially, that you're going to lead this relationship. Mm-hmm. Like if a guy can't lead a first date, how's he going to lead your children, you know? And so, I mean, and I know that different guys have different, you know, leadership capacities and things, but I think that's something that guys, a lot of times guys are like, well, let's just see what happens. And it's like, no, you're the intentional one here.
Yeah.
Like you've asked for this date, maybe, mm-hmm. you know, who knows, but you know, you've asked for this date and it, you should kind of have things you want to talk about, things you want to do. Because most women, I find, really just want the guy to take the lead, and just they're kind of like, you know, I'm just with you, you know, for this amount of time. Mm-hmm. And I think another thing, and this is probably a mistake that I make a lot, I'm kind of a conversational person. I like just talking to people to get to know people. But sometimes in those first couple of dates, doing things takes the pressure off. Mm-hmm. You know, yeah. where if you go to the zoo or go do something, mm-hmm. you're building a memory and kind of the... you're kind of sharing an experience where it's not just about, you know, I have all these questions for you and you probably have some for me. Let's just get to brass tacks.
And there's things around you to talk about.
You don't have to.
Good point.
Right. Yeah.
And can prompt other conversations.
Yeah.
Okay. So what are, as you look back again, we're getting back to that first date. What are historically, what have been your deal breakers? What have you said or observed or noticed where you're like, yeah, this isn't going to the second date? Because I think my theory is that guys are looking much more for a spark or a connection or to click, whereas I think women tend to look more at objective things like, he was cheap, his pants were terrible, his, you know,
oh,
whatever.
Bad.
He
Women
said,
noticed that?
He said really dumb. He said really dumb. I don't know. That's just in the conversations I've had.
His pants.
I've gone out with some horrible pants, people.
I need to go
well,
buy some
I'll
pants.
Speak from my experience, and I actually had another friend confirm that this happened for her too, but where the conversation became a debate, made things awkward like just conflict or, I mean, not that you're even arguing, but you want to find commonalities and be friendly in your conversation. But when it becomes, are you pre-millennium or post-millennium, that is awkward.
But do you think, I mean, do you think looking back on that, is that person really like that or were they just trying to impress you? I mean, that's where I kind of wonder, like, how many people need a second chance because they're just weird because they're trying to sound all smart? I don't know. Maybe I've turned down too many second dates because of that kind of stuff.
I've definitely had dates that were adversarial, like a first date that became very adversarial. And it's kind of hard to pinpoint the exact conversation, how it got there. But you just felt like we were feeding a negative energy that wasn't healthy. And I didn't come away with that thinking it was playful banter or it was flirtation at all. And I was usually right about that instinct. And to Martha's point there is that when it comes across that way, it can be very distracting and kind of leave a bad taste in your mouth. You're like, I don't really want to see that person again. But at the same time, I don't really want to tell them I don't want to see them again because it was such a bad first date in the first place.
Yeah. I think for me, the thing that kind of jumps out as I'm thinking about this question is the thing that like will really turn me off really quick is if a woman is negative or shows contempt for men in her life. Even if they deserve it, that does something in my heart where if they'll kind of say, oh yeah, like my dad, like he's such a deadbeat or other guys, or even like guys that they've dated before, like, oh man, you're not like those other idiots. That immediately triggers something in me where it's like, wow, you know, like, how long until I'm the
until
idiot?
You're the
you know? And so I think that goes both ways. I mean, guys have to watch that too, but I think that most guys are looking for somebody who will be on their team, who generally like, you know, will be supportive of them. And I think guys watch for things subtly where it's like, you know, you're negative towards a lot of guys. And that, I think that's something that I've seen.
Mm-hmm. Oh. Yeah.
I think another thing that I would look for is manners of just, I mean, if this is an opportunity to meet face to face, maybe with someone you haven't met before, just, I mean, not that you would not go out on another date because of this, but just, do they hold their fork properly? Do they
talk?
What is proper?
Can we get a fork?
British, the British way or the American?
Not with a fist, okay? But how do they treat the waiter?
Like, maybe they use a fork. That's good.
Do they talk with their mouth full? Or I don't know. I mean, just kind of gives you a sense
well,
of...
And I get you. I think going back to manners, that's a good point because, again, this goes back to the man leading this first date because if she's meeting you somewhere, especially if this is a blind date, don't be sitting at your table way at the back of the restaurant on your phone and casually glance up and, oh, hey, back here. You know, meet her up front. Take her back there. Take off that pressure of the, well, I'm a kind of a fish out of water in this scenario, and there's the guy I'm supposed to meet. Oh, yeah, there he is. He saw me, I think. I don't really know. Be there for her. Be there up front. And then show your manners later. Manners especially to the wait staff, too, because I'm sure the ladies pick up on how your courtesy towards the wait staff.
Yeah, I think that hits on a lot of guys in an initial date, if they don't know somebody, can be really nervous about, you know, awkwardness, like in a dating situation. And you think about things like, should I open her door or should I, you know, get her chair for her? And I think a lot of these like chivalrous things that guys are supposed to do, we are a little nervous about making an awkward situation. And the thing that I've kind of come to is in those situations, we should just... you know, do the serving thing. Like just, if you're gonna make a mistake in serving. And sometimes it is awkward. Like I was actually ushering at a wedding just a couple of weeks ago and we were supposed to take them down the aisle and we did that. And there's one woman came up and I was like, can I lead you to your seat? And she's like, no, I can get there myself. And it kind of was like a shaming thing. Like, why do you want me to take me to my seat? And I was just like, you know, that's something that you have to be careful of is, you don't want to, If he's trying to do something nice for you, don't ever make them feel like, oh, wow, I'm ashamed because I tried to help you.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know? Yeah. Okay, so what about our attitudes needs to change or lessons learned? So I know, Nathan, you talked about maturing through the process of dating and what you learned. what would you guys say? Like, if we were strictly tasked with saying, okay, you need to get your numbers up, you need to have a higher percentage of second dates, what do you need to do to get there? What about your attitude has to change?
Well, I've had a pretty good record so far, but I mean, but I think when the one time when I did decline a guy from a second date, like it was by email that I told him I wasn't interested or whatever, but he replied with a thank you, of just thank you for being honest and telling me that. And mm-hmm. I think that's an important lesson of when you're debating, you know, what's next, just be real with each other about where you're at.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I think for me, like the thing that I'm learning is that a lot of times we think about the intentionality of initiating a first date, but there's also an intentionality of initiating a second date and a third date, mm-hmm. and like you've kind of started something, especially in her mind. Mm-hmm. Like it's kind of like, where's this going? Mm-hmm. And so you can't just go on a first date and then like let that be it. And I don't know. That's mm-hmm. that's a tough one, and maybe you guys can speak to that, because for me, when it's one or two dates, it's kind of like, let's just, you know, see what happens, and I don't feel like I have to close the loop and like kind of formally say, here is what I'm thinking.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing,
mm-hmm.
you know. And so I don't know. I mean, I know women appreciate kind of, you know, being clear about intentions and things like that, but mm-hmm. I think for me, there's been a lot of times where there probably should have been a second or third date and my life was busy and I just didn't prioritize. I need to get something on the calendar or make sure that I don't just, you know, drop the ball because life is
right,
busy.
Well, you obviously couldn't have been that into them if, like, yeah.
True.
It was more just like, oh yeah, they were okay. Maybe I could give it a second chance.
True. But
life got in.
But yeah, but I would say there's definitely a handful of women that I look back and I'm like, that probably could have worked.
Mm-hmm.
I just, you know, either it didn't feel right or it wasn't mm-hmm. the right time for me, and probably should just push through that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but I don't know.
Okay.
I definitely have matured in the sense that every time I would finish talking, I'd start a countdown to when I could talk again. Was what I would do. I mean, that's uh-huh. blatantly a blatant admission there of what I would do, because I, when she was talking, I didn't register any of it. I wasn't genuinely interested in it. I was just wanted to make sure that she fit with my opinions and that I had an opinion on things and that she had to fit in that. Otherwise, we're going to have problems.
Mm-hmm.
And I look back on that and I think how far I've grown, because I know with my wife, I was genuinely interested on our first date, why she had moved out to the state, what she was doing, what her work consisted of, her school experiences. I wanted to know her opinion on things, and I just kind of come into that on my own, and I took a genuine interest to the point where I remember her saying, I'd ask her a follow-up question a couple dates later about, you told me on your first date about your brother and mm-hmm. what's he doing, and mm-hmm. and she was impressed by that, and I didn't do that. I didn't say I'm gonna file that away and bust it out on the third date and score mm-hmm. some brownie points. I did that because I genuinely had a heart change, and I didn't care about the fact that if she didn't agree with all my opinions, that would matter so much.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think I would do well to not, I know on a couple first dates I've been on where I did really like the person, I just almost got into like podcast mode. Probably I asked too many questions. I was probably just like, you know, like boring into their life or something. And they're just like, please. And then in recounting one of these dates to one of my friends, she's like, I don't know if you left like anything on the table to talk about. So she felt like I was just like, where's the mystery kind of thing? You know, I was just too much info, not like inappropriate info, but just, you know, let me share my whole life and ask you about yours, you know? So
yeah.
I think that's probably something I could learn from and probably not, you know, maybe share that I host a podcast, and if the date doesn't go well, it will be on the show. I need to not disclose
that. Can be
that.
Intimidating.
That's like Andrew was saying.
Andrew, yeah.
Kind of bad.
Another thing that jumps into my mind is, especially today, and this has probably changed in the last 10 years, is I think a lot of us are very undisciplined about how we stalk people on social media,
mm-hmm.
and that, you know, maybe even before the first date, you're finding
we
them
feel
on
like
Facebook.
We've already dated them.
Yeah. And you're looking through, I mean, sometimes hundreds of pictures of their experiences mm-hmm. and making judgment calls on who they are based on their pictures. Now, mm-hmm. in some ways, you know, that's just the world we live in, and people should be responsible to not, you know, like if I am, you know, if I go on a date with a girl and I see pictures of her partying and it's kind of like, whoa, this girl must be really wild. And that might not be the case. It might have just been, you know, just a, you know, a half hour and she really didn't want to be there. And,
right.
But I think that we have to learn how to manage our persona on social media, mm-hmm. and not take advantage of, because it is easy to do where it's like, you're really interested in this person. It's like, wow, I can go find out a lot of information about them.
Yeah.
Online.
And another thing that's not fair about that is you can compare, if you have mutual friends who they get along with, you know, and they're in your mind, you may think, well, I don't have any friends that we share with them, which would not even have been a question that entered your mind a decade ago.
Yeah.
But Facebook has made us all 6 degrees away from each other.
Yeah.
That
yeah.
if you don't have 8 or more mutual friends with this person, they're not enough like you. Mm-hmm. They're not going to get along with your friends, and it's just going to be a disaster. And you create that kind of firestorm in your head that plays out in conversation when you're on the date, and it's a self-fulfilling prophecy, and you tank the date because you've already made these calls in your head about mm-hmm. where this could go.
Yeah.
So after the date, I know girls, I've heard the conversations of, you know, they'll text the guy later of, you know, thank you for a good evening. And they're wanting to encourage you to mm-hmm. ask out again and feel like they've done all their possible. I'm just wondering, does that make a difference?
Yes.
Does their communication?
Does.
Okay.
Huge difference.
How do you do it well?
Well, it makes a difference if you're interested in them, I would imagine.
It does. Yeah. That's important.
Well, if you're not, bummer for them.
Yeah. I think the thing to like, is you don't want to say, wow, you are such an amazing guy. Like that's overkill. But if you say something like, this is a lot of fun.
I can see you as the father of my children.
I pictured my kids.
I've heard
you.
That guys appreciate compliments that are more about what you did for them than mm-hmm. about them personally.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like true? thanks for lunch or thanks for the coffee or
yes.
this was, I really enjoyed this. Mm-hmm. That it means more than like, wow, mm-hmm. you are just so cool. Or, I mean, which, I don't
know. No, you know what? Here's the best comment ever. You are hilarious. Mm-hmm. That'll get you a second date.
Well, that's true.
If there's any chance. I know, because guys love being told
they're
funny.
My future wife better think I'm funny.
You are so hilarious. I just couldn't stop laughing. Okay.
I think my wife sent me, I had a great time. Thank you for dinner. Mm-hmm. /.
There's smiley, the pattern.
Face.
And you got married.
Blind face.
That she said that, but not right after. You know, the timing thing is got to wait till.
Yeah.
That's a whole nother ball of wax that I can't speak to. I just felt like whether she sent that at 10 p.m. that night or 6 p.m. the next day, it didn't really matter as long as it was still fresh on my mind that we had the date. That's all that mattered.
Okay, last question, you guys, because we need to know this. This is another question from the ladies, and Martha's taking out a tissue. After that first date, what is the reasonable amount of time that a woman should expect to wait for you to ask her out, and when should she give up hope, as in like, oh no, he doesn't just have time commitments and he's not just busy, or he didn't lose your number, he just isn't interested. What will happen? What's the expectation?
I would think that he is thinking, I want to do something with her the next weekend.
Yeah.
So probably within 5 to 7 days, you should expect to hear from him again. Unless, like, and sometimes a guy will even say, hey, I have this coming up next weekend, just so you know, hold on, like I'm,
okay.
like I just have this thing going on. But I think if it's been 2 weeks and you haven't heard anything, that's probably a bad sign.
Okay. Yeah, I agree. You were not going to hear anything after 2 weeks, 5 to 7 days. Now that doesn't mean don't go ahead and make plans if something's coming up, but also communicate to him if he does ask you out and you have plans, tell him that. Say, I have plans, but I would like to see you mm-hmm. this date. And that's, guys like to hear that too, because then it's not a brush off. It's a, I mm-hmm. do want to see you. I have other plans. It also makes you more valuable in his eyes because you do have a life going on here. Mm-hmm. You're not at home with your cats.
Which is a big red flag.
Yeah.
Okay. Good thoughts, you guys. Thank you so much, everyone, for being honest about this. Woo woo. Your eyes are burning with fire. The groom's eyes, they burn with desire for a lover who's waiting. Oh, for the love of her life. And I would be the one. All right. Hey, everyone. You know, we love our culture segments here at The Boundless Show. And today is no exception because we have the privilege of having Dr. John Townsend in the studio. Hey, Dr. John.
Hey, Lisa.
Very good to have you. Now, we were just talking about your buddy, Dr. Cloud, with whom you have done radio for many years. Mm-hmm. You have written books. Mm-hmm. And he has been here on the show as well. So, but you know, sometimes we talk to people individually. We don't always have to talk to people in pairs. You know, it's like Dr. Townsend has his own gig, right?
Well, there's a me and there's a him and there's a we. Right. We got all three there.
Right. It's kind of like a marriage in a way. But Dr. Townsend is a psychologist. I did refer to him as being an author. Many of you have read Boundaries, and you guys have read Boundaries in Dating, all the things related to boundaries that he's written either by himself or with Dr. Cloud. And also, you may listen to New Life Live, which is a radio program that he does. He's also the co-founder of the Cloud Townsend Clinic and Cloud Townsend Resources. And we're very privileged to have you here today.
Great to be here.
Well, this is fun because we are actually going to talk about a couple things. One is a newer book that he has called Beyond Boundaries, Learning to Trust Again in Relationships. And actually, you also have a new book coming out on entitlement. So you're going to have to tell us a little bit about that as well, because we tell young adults here not to be entitled, especially as it relates to leadership and the things that you are going to be talking about. So we want to make sure we touch on that as well. But first off, I want to talk about boundaries and beyond boundaries, because people here are probably like schizophrenic saying, okay, seriously, like, first you told me I had to have boundaries, Dr. Townsend, now you're telling me I need to bring those boundaries down. So let's talk a little bit about, and I think it's interesting because you do so much work in the realm of leadership as well. And I mean, you train corporate leaders. And I heard a pastor speak not too long ago about he was brought into a group of CEOs, corporate CEOs. And the first thing he asked him was, do you guys have a business plan? Have you created a business plan? And of course, they're all like, yeah, yeah, yeah. And then he said, well, do you have a life plan? And he just got blank stares. And so I think there are probably a lot of leaders out there, corporate and otherwise, who are climbing the ladder, leading huge Fortune 500 companies, and have personal lives that are a shambles. So the good thing is here, we get to glean from, you know, wherever you are, whatever you're doing in your career, whether you're in school or whatever, I think there are great principles here to be learned. So let's start, though, by talking about that first question of, you know, when you talk about boundaries, what, like, describe that for, like, a single young adult, like how that plays into relationships, not only as they're growing into adulthood and kind of making that separation between, okay, I'm leaving my family in that sense, I'm spreading my wings, getting out on my own. How do they navigate relationships as to what some of those should look like moving into their 20s? What's appropriate? What's not?
Yeah. Simply put, Lisa, a boundary is a property line that distinguishes what you're responsible for and what you're not responsible for. Now, if you look at Genesis 2, where the famous passage about how we need to leave and cleave, and singles are in that realm. I mean, at the early stages when you're just leaving home, you haven't quite left yet, but God's structure is that sooner or later, I'm going to own my life, I'm going to own my finances, I'm going to own my relationships. And so boundaries are a big part of becoming a functional single person. Then there's another kind of boundary that has to do with what kind of things I will and will allow in my single life. Like, what kind of conversations do I have with my friends? What do I do with my money? What do I do with toxic people in my life? So boundaries are basically a protective structure based on Proverbs 4:23, where Solomon says, guard your heart. They're a way to guard our hearts.
Mm-hmm. So how does that look? Like, for example, I know there are a lot of, for single young adults, you know, maybe who aren't in a dating relationship yet or aren't moving towards marriage, really friendships are kind of the core of where they are. What should this look like, boundaries, first of all? What should that look like for a person who maybe has someone who really wants to be your best friend, and you're like, well, I don't really need another best friend.
Yeah, I'm your bestie, but you're not my bestie.
Because in the church, that's so hard. You don't want to hurt people. You don't want to make them feel bad. You know, so how do you navigate that?
Well, first you got to navigate it internally. Mm-hmm. You've got to determine, when I work with singles, I have them sometimes determine, what do they want in life? What are your goals relationally, the shape you're in, your career, all that, and what's going to take to get your goals, and what kind of support team do you need to get there? And you find out, well, I need some people that are like me in these areas, and they can challenge me here, and this sort of thing. And those are kind of your, what I call your life team. You're talking about your life plan. Mm-hmm. But then you've got people that really aren't that, but they're nice people. Well, they may want you to be their life team. I don't think you could have probably more than 3 to 7 people in a really deep life team. Mm-hmm. And so if people are number 8 or 9 or 10 or 12, then if they say, I want to meet with you a lot. Sometimes, and I don't think you need to be mean about this, sometimes you got to say, I can't meet you every week, but could I meet you once a month? And those are appropriate boundaries where you keep the friendship, but you've got to be a guardian of your time and your energy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's true. And it's hard because I think it's, you know, we are often preached at in church about letting everyone into our lives and this idea of Christian community.
You know what I found about that, Lisa, is that when I work with singles who struggle with this, mm-hmm. every time is that they let people pick them and mm-hmm. they're not picking people. Mm-hmm. And if you look at who's spending their time per month with them, they'll go, well, they wanted me because I'm smart or I'm loving or I'm spiritual or I'm in shape or I've got money or whatever. They're allowing people to pick them as besties, and they're not saying, who do I need to fulfill my role in life? You've got to be more intentional.
Yeah, well, it's another weird form of passivity that we're so guilty of when
it
comes to...
passivity is very... You don't see a lot of attaboys about passivity in the scriptures.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So help us break this vicious cycle then of, you know, so many young adults out there, and we've done shows on dating, you know, users and abusers and just these relationships.
By the way, that's a bad idea.
Right. That is a bad idea. I was hoping you weren't going to disagree with me because then I'd be like, whoa, that's awkward. But kind of that whole concept. So we get into these bad relationships and then we figure out, you know, some way we have to either extricate ourselves or else it blows up and we end up in counseling, been there. And but then now you're telling us in Beyond Boundaries that eventually we have to learn to trust again. How do we keep this from being cyclical? How do we get healthy?
It's a confusing title, Beyond Boundaries. Mm-hmm. And here's the real answer, Lisa, is there's two kinds of boundaries. They're what I call in the book defined boundaries. And your boundaries are your core values, what you believe in, God and relationship and holiness and success. They'll never change. You don't give up those boundaries because they define who you are. But then the second boundary is your protective boundaries, where you have to kind of put up a moat against some people who are toxic or what you call users and abusers. Mm-hmm. And those are the ones that can change depending on the circumstances. When do you let the moat drawer back down? The book is about how do I know when to trust again and not be so self-protective so that I can find love and fulfillment and friendship and romance and all those good things.
Mm-hmm. And how does someone know, whether it's a family member you've been hurt by or whether it's a close friend or whether it is someone you've been dating or even, you know, we get lots of letters from people that were engaged and just were betrayed or whatever. How do you know when it is time to trust again?
Well, that's the nature of the book. I've got it in three sections. Mm-hmm. And section one is, first, I've got to know I'm ready. You know, we can get wounded. We get wounded by each other. And people, like you said, betrayal makes us, you know, not trust. Or sometimes we have trigger responses, almost like post-traumatic stress disorder responses where we freeze up or get terrified. So I've got to heal. I've got to be in a healing community, maybe find a good therapist. But that's part one is, how do you know when you're ready? And there are steps I say in the book about how you know when you're ready to trust. Second part of the book is, how do I know the other person's ready? There's a big difference between somebody who says, I'm sorry that I did that. I'm sorry I lied or controlled you or shamed you or criticized you, and a person who actually changes. So I have a whole section in the book basically of, have they shown internal change and not just, I'm sorry. Sorry is about as good as the words are. What does Gump say? Sorry is what sorry does. Mm-hmm. Are they doing sorry?
Hmm.
And then the third part of the book is what I call the dance of, how do you have the conversations where you sort of like tiptoe towards each other? Because I have a whole part on there of, we need to have the conversation about us now.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you do that and all three parts line up, you can go back in a relationship again.
Yeah, I know you talk specifically about what you call the talk you must have.
The talk you must have.
And so what is that? I mean, what if you're just dating like a total player? So who, like, you know, I have girlfriends that dated guys that they basically, because of their faith, they said, well, everything's under the blood of Jesus and I just have to let it go. You know, these horrible paths. I mean, they're kind of like, well, I think they're working through it, or I think they're whatever, and I think they ask forgiveness, and I think, and so there may be, how do you know the difference between true repentance and mistakes, now I've changed, and just there are red flags that I shouldn't be going there?
We know Jesus addressed that, Lisa, when he said, you brood of vipers, actually John the Baptist said this, he said, you brood of vipers, bring forth fruits that are meet with repentance. In other words, if you have had these internal changes, you've got to show by your actions that you're listening better, that your behavior is on the same level with your belief system, that you're living the righteous life, not a perfect life, but you're on the path. So what I always have to tell singles when they've had a blow up like you're talking about, mm-hmm. you can't do this by the next week. You've got to observe that person and their behavior in community so other people have x-ray vision as well as you, because you're kind of crazy because you're distorted. Over time, that's the key, is over time. And have they changed?
Okay. So say that you are, you know, for those in our audience who are maybe young marrieds, or maybe this is a relationship with a family member that they're, you know, they can't just walk away from. What do we do when it's other people's walls that we can't break down? So someone who's refusing to trust us, or who's refusing to move forward, or who's refusing, you know, it's something where we want to restore that relationship, but they're not ready.
Mm-hmm. I think the very first thing we can do is have the conversation where you go to Matthew 7, and it said to take the beam out of your eye before you take the mote out of your brother's eye, and go to that person and say, I miss us. I miss our relationship. And I'd like to have a conversation to find out what I've done to alienate things, as opposed to, well, you have a responsibility to be with me because I'm sad, I'm sorry, or whatever, or you're making this up, or you're overreacting. To go in and say, I'd like to know how I've impacted you, because I need to learn from this and I miss the relationship. That sort of vulnerable response, instead of an angry, blaming response, soft answer turns away wrath. And you often, and I've seen on a kind of a bell curve level, a high percentage of the conversations with person will go, you really want to know how you affected me? Yeah. Well, 4 years ago at that party, you made so much fun of me that I never forgot it. And you say, I hardly remember it. I'm so sorry. Tell me more. A lot of times when reconciliation happens.
Yeah, which is so sad, because a lot of times we don't even get to that point in the church. We just so...
You know what we do?
Yeah.
We either don't do anything, or then we go nuclear.
Yeah.
Like, well, they wouldn't return my phone call. Well, I'll shake the dust off my sandals.
Yeah.
Well, there's a lot of steps, Lisa, in between we're upset and shake the dust off that Christians don't do.
Yeah. Or we just go to the church down the street. It's just they abandon the whole situation.
Exactly.
So what are the, like, talk to us. I mean, obviously where you go here is very deep and very specific and very much like, I want to redeem this relationship. Talk about the baby steps just within the church as to, I mean, I feel like sometimes I'm just like looking around going, is there anyone here that even wants a real relationship? Yeah. Because why do people just want to do these game nights and go out to lunch with me, but never talk about anything real? What's the problem in the church, and how can we move in a direction that helps us be more real and have that kind of relationship?
Well, I think there are several problems. First off, I think that in a healthy church, true intimacy and vulnerability got to be preached from the pulpit, where it's more than just reading your Bible and having a quiet time. The Bible says to read the Bible and have a quiet time, but it also says to do everything the Bible says, to put your Bible down, so to speak, and go love one another. Like it says in James 1, it says, the person that just looks at the word and doesn't do anything is like the person looks in the mirror. Nothing transactional happened. We're supposed to accept one another, speak the truth in love, confess to one another, you know, love one another. So it's got to be preached. And in a singles group or a small group or whatever, I think that every person, I'm personally committed to a small group until the bus hits me at 87 or whatever, because there's the worship service where you're facing each other, and then there's bowling, which is fun, or some a baseball game. But you've got to have, I don't think you can really grow as a Christian without a room, Lisa, where all the chairs face each other, where you're talking about life the way it's really lived, and it's safe, and it's full of grace and truth and no condemnation. And if you don't have that, nothing transformational ever happens.
Yeah. Okay, so speaking of which, I want to transition a little bit here, because you have a new book coming out that I want to give everyone a sneak peek of. It's called The Hard Way is the Right Way, How Successful People Succeed by Rolling Up Their Sleeves in a Culture of Entitlement.
Pretty long subtitle,
that,
huh?
That is. Who came up with that? Was that
I
you?
I did, and I think they're going to shorten it.
Okay, well, either way, it's about doing hard things and not being entitled, which is great, because we talk about that a lot here at Boundless, because I think millennials especially get so blamed for this, of just, you know, I'm just going to be amazing by the time I'm 22 and I won't have any room to grow.
Yeah, and it's certainly, I think sometimes millennials get really bashed too hard on all this. I mean, I know people,
they're
know.
They're too busy trying to figure things out to, yeah.
Yeah, but people of all ages have the same problem. Who wants to do hard things? I don't want to do hard things. When I'm feeling bad, I don't want to be nice to my kids. And when I'm tired, I want to go eat, you know, chocolate pie. I mean, but the book is about the fact that we need to, if we want to be successful, you've got to be creative, you've got to be innovative, you've got to have passion. But at the same time, we've got to be like the ant in Proverbs chapter 6, and it says she didn't have a chief or a captain, but every day she does the job. And I talk about things like learning to do repetitive things without going crazy. We all hate repetitive things, but successful people do repetitive things. Doing things that you're not really good at. You know, sometimes if you're a good salesperson, a marketing person, and you go, well, I don't need to have it balance my checkbook. That's somebody else's gift. No, you've got to balance your checkbook. So learning those essential disciplines that can really escalate your life, your relationships, and your career.
Okay, so how do we do that when everything that we're told, whether it's in education or in the workplace or whatever, is that do not do anything that you're going to fail at because someone will notice it and they will demote you or they will make fun of you or they will... How do we get the confidence to even try things?
Well, and there's some truth to that, too. Mm-hmm. And you certainly shouldn't fall on your face in the middle of a board meeting. That's not a good idea. Mm-hmm. But there's got to be a context, I think, Lisa, a safe place where you are loved and accepted, where you can learn to struggle and fail and try things. For example, I talk about... Things that you don't do well, like maybe you don't have a hard time confronting people because mm-hmm. you're the nice guy. Well, if you don't learn the skill of confrontation, you're going to be used by people all your life. You'll never get anywhere. So where can you find the way to be truthful with people, solve problems with people? You've got to find kind of a learning environment, which I think is a good safe group, a good process group, a good spiritual director, a good mentor, a good counselor.
Yeah. So you talked about how you naturally don't like to do hard things. Which you should, because you're a famous psychologist, so you should totally be beyond that. I'm just teasing.
The fact that I have a belly button means I don't like to do hard things.
Oh, okay. Okay, so what, can you give an example, like, from your own life where there was something that you knew, you know, just in your nature, that this is somewhere I don't want to go, but you did, and you've seen growth out of that, or you've seen movement?
I'll give you a little teeny story and a big story.
Okay.
How's that? Teeny story. I speak a lot, and I'm traveling a lot, and I'm always in conferences and hotels. And I was in between. I was at a conference in Washington, D.C. this last week. And I was speaking, and I did a radio interview, and then I had like 15 minutes to run to my room and then to go back down again. And this sounds really silly, but I knew my breath was really bad by now because I had 18 cups of coffee and all this. So I ran up. I thought, well, I've got a little mouthwash here. I got to brush my teeth. But this sounds so silly saying it, but it's trivial, but it's not. So I thought, okay, I'll just do the mouthwash. Then I thought, wait a minute, I've got to be a steward of these teeth. You know, I'm not going to keep these forever. So I took another 2 minutes to brush my teeth, and I kept saying to myself, this is the hard way. This is the hard way. And I went down, and I felt a little bit better about navigating life, and I'm sure people around me appreciate that.
Felt better.
Little example. Big example would be when I had to make the decision about a business that I had and whether to sell it or not to sell it. And the easy way would have been to hold on to it, and it was in a failing industry. And the hard thing would be to let go of something I loved and do something else. But I felt like it wasn't the direction I wanted to go, so I had to have a lot of hard talks with a lot of people, finally got the business sold, and then God opened up another total area for me that had bore a lot of fruit. But it was against my nature to do that.
Hmm.
I wanted to hold on to the old.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I have been there. So, and which is weird because I'm naturally a risk taker, you know, which is funny because when I talk to my friends that aren't, they think that all of my decisions are so easy. Oh, Lisa, you just love doing that. You're just willing to put it out there. You're just whatever.
And you're saying, no, it's not.
Yeah, no, it's not. I mean, I think it depends. There are some things that are easy for me to do and some areas that are much more difficult.
For some people on an emotional level, vulnerability is very easy. And like being truthful is hard. Mm-hmm. For some people, it's really easy to kind of lay out the truth, very difficult to be vulnerable. So the book's about finding out what you need to do to get successful that you're not naturally good at and learning how to do it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's good. So kind of as we wrap here, Dr. Townsend, what would you say, knowing that you're speaking to thousands, probably hundreds of thousands of young adults here, as they're kind of navigating their 20s into their 30s, some of them looking back and saying, oh my word, there's definitely some missed opportunities here. Some just saying, I don't even know where I'm going. What would you say from what you know in leadership and beyond are just some good things that they can be doing right now to understand where they are in relationships, understand how they need to move, and what really is going to make them get some gains in the short term and in the long term?
I spend a lot of time with young adult leaders. I have a leadership coaching program, which has a lot of young adult leaders in it. So I kind of study their DNA. And the best thing I have found that helps is to tell them, you came from a family, a biological family or whoever they were, and they raised you and they did good things. And they taught you values and support, but they probably did some bad things too and didn't finish equipping you for life. There's some holes like in all of us about being equipped for life. Well, that's what I call the family of origin scenario. Your job now is to give that up and do what the Bible says, leaving and cleaving, and to find the family of God. You need a second family, and the second family is bigger and greater and more wonderful than the first family. And you've got to get all those things from the family of God that you didn't get from the family of origin. And if you do that, you will be a successful person.
Hmm. All right. Well, good thoughts. Thank you so much, Dr. Townsend, for being with us. Again, I want to let you guys know, don't forget Beyond Boundaries. We talked about that on the front end of the show. Pick up a copy of that. We will have it linked on the blog, as well as The Hard Way is the Right Way.
Can I get my website?
You absolutely can.
drtownsend.com.
Dr, as in doctor, Townsend.com, and we will link to that as well on the blog so you can figure out where in the world he's going next. He's speaking all over the place, just out and about doing many different things. I mean, you're very involved with not only the radio show, but you speak. I mean, you and Dr. Cloud have been involved with the Willow Creek Leadership Association, among others. So all of us Boundless fans, we can find him out there. You can stalk him. That's good. So thank you so much for being part of this conversation, Dr. Townsend.
Great to be here. It's running through my veins. I chose my pride instead of the glory of your name. All the wrath of God that I deserve with every breath fell upon him. And he loved my heart today.
Well, folks, as we round out the show, we have our inbox segment, which so many of you love. You love to hear the questions that are being asked. And I just love the honesty and vulnerability that a lot of people put out there when they ask these questions. And I know that they're ones that many of us are thinking. And this week's question is one that we have not gotten before. And so we brought in Cynthia Gervais, one of our counselors, who is going to answer this for us, having a lot of experience in this realm in counseling folks and different areas of expertise. And so here we go. Our listener says, I'm a young Christian in my mid-20s and at the point of considering entering relationships with the intention of finding a spouse. The problem is I have a history of childhood sexual abuse, and as a result, I have an STD. I feel apprehensive about dating. Should I resort to using dating websites specifically made for people with my condition, or should I still seek relationship with Christians that I come in contact with, develop trust, and at the right time explain my condition to that person? It's a tough one.
It is. It's a very tough question. First, let me say I am so sorry for your childhood sexual abuse. We as Christians often end up dealing with the consequences of someone else's sin because we live in a broken world that is full of sin. You're not alone in this tough situation. There are other Christians who deal with having STDs through no fault of their own for various reasons and circumstances. And you are dealing with one of the same struggles that others in this situation have. Being responsible regarding the STD that you have is something that you should take very seriously. When and how you should make that known to someone you're in a relationship with depends on several things. First, how is the STD transmitted? Many STDs are transmitted through bodily fluids, which can include kissing. So first you need to know how the STD that you have can be transmitted. Then you can set up healthy physical boundaries when you are first meeting and getting to know someone. And I think it's crucial that you know what the boundaries need to be and that you communicate those boundaries up front so that there's no question. If you were to set up your dating relationship more like a courting relationship, you would be able to establish who is truly interested in knowing you and about you versus the physical aspect of a relationship. And sometimes that's hard to tell when you're first meeting somebody and engaging with them. I cannot express how important it is for you to be in prayer about the timing of the disclosure, because I think that that is so very important. Invest some time in knowing the things that are most important for you to see in someone that you would like to spend your life with, and what are the things that would be deal breakers in any relationship. This will help you to invest your time wisely in a relationship that's going to have the most potential for you. Next, I would suggest that you tell the person you have chosen to begin investing in that you would like to share something in confidence with them, and request that they keep your confidence. Ask if they can keep your confidence and wait for their answer. If they say yes, then share that you have a history of childhood sexual abuse first. See how they handle that information first. How do they respond? Do they back away because they don't know what to say? If so, consider how they're going to respond to information that you have an STD. If they express sorrow that you've had to deal with childhood abuse and want to know how or what they can do in your relationship to be sensitive to that, that's a much better response. And that's really what you want to look for is, how are they going to respond? Is it going to be positive in a way that you feel safe? Is it going to be negative where you feel like, what do I do? This person, you know, I've told and maybe I shouldn't have told. Then those are red flags that you need to be very attentive to, and just know that you might need to back away a little bit and see whether or not they're going to hold your confidence. You might also look at using the book Boundaries and Dating by Henry Cloud and John Townsend as a study to go through with someone that you want to start dating. This can help you get on the same page about healthy boundaries in the dating relationship. They also have a section where you can talk about family of origin issues, and that can be an open door to talk about childhood sexual abuse, and that can give you some guidelines and direction about when it's appropriate to share that information and to have that conversation.
Mm-hmm. Oh, good thoughts, Cynthia. Thanks so much for weighing in on that and answering that question comprehensively for this person. I think in the future, maybe we'll have to take the other side of that and address, you know, a person who, when that information's been revealed to you, where does that put you? How do you respond appropriately? And then also, you know, does that mean, where does that come into play? I mean, should we be dating every person, every Christian that comes to us and has an STD, or where do, you know, what does that look like? So, because right. I think some people will be like, what does that mean?
Right.
So, good thoughts there, but that was a great start on that one side of the conversation. So thanks so much.
Yeah, that is just the tip of the iceberg mm-hmm. in regards to
sure
what
is.
That conversation could look like.
Absolutely. Well, that is it for this week's show, everyone. Do write to us at editor@boundless.org with your question in the future. We get a lot each week, and we like wading through those and presenting them to you and getting appropriate people to answer them. So make sure you are catching up on the shows as they come about, and share them with your friends, especially if you see an inbox question or similar that you know really addresses something that one of your friends has been struggling with, because we want to be there to help. So that is it for this week's show. I'm your host, Lisa Anderson, for The Boundless Show.
The Boundless Show is a production of Boundless.org, focused on the family.
A donor-supported ministry of Focus on the Family.